This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's one of those topics that screams clickbait when you go online. A miracle substance that's guaranteed to turn back the clock of aging. Somehow, those Hollywood celebrities have access to this product that makes them look fit and young and wonderful and super fantastic, but not the scientific community? What's really going on with anti-aging? San Antonio actually is home to one of the world's leading research facilities that delves into anti-aging. They look at why we age. What does it actually mean to age? Why we age at the rate we do individually and as a whole, and what can be done about it? It's the Barshop Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies. It's part of the UT Health Science Center in San Antonio. We're joined by three of their researchers, Dr. Nicolas Musi. He is the director of the Bar Shop. His specialty is exercise, the benefit of exercise. Dr. Veronica Galvan, she's a professor in the Department of Cellular and Integrative Physiology, and she's looking at Alzheimer's. And Dr. Sarah Espinosa, professor of medicine at the Bar Shop. Her area is frailty studies. And our phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment about aging, how to fight aging, what we can do to avoid aging acceleration. I think it's probably the first thing I want to do is stop aging so fast. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. So Dr. Musi, since you are the director, what's going on there? How excited should we be about what's happening with anti-aging research?
Well, thank you for the invitation. This is a very exciting time locally and in the overall field of aging. Major breakthroughs have been done in recent years that have helped us understand what are the molecular processes that control the aging process and the rate of aging. And this opens the possibility of developing interventions that can improve the way we age and stay healthy as we age. And also, the hope is that we can develop new treatments and preventative strategies for common diseases of aging. So it's an extremely exciting time in the field.
So right now, the only solution that we have for aging is just to drop dead right now. Then you won't age anymore. You're pretty much going to be inert at that point. What we want to do is find ways to figure out what happens to us as we age. And so there's a panorama of different things that happen to the body as we travel through time. So how do y'all look at it? What terminology or what's the scope, what's the mindset that you look at when you talk about aging?
Yes, so traditionally the concept of aging is one that essentially our cells, our organs, our body just stops functioning or as it should be. This process particularly regulated in some shape or form. But what we and or the community, scientific community, has learned is that the process of aging is highly regulated, just as many other processes in our cells and organs, how our cells divide, how our cells grow, how they die. The rate by which our cells, our organs, and our body ages is tightly regulated. And we are beginning to understand what are the cellular mechanisms, meaning genes and proteins and enzymes that control the process of aging. And that this opens the door for manipulating this. And the goal is not really to just live longer, but really to age in a more healthier way. Also, aging per se is the main causes of disability and death, including cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, osteoporosis. And the idea is that if we can improve the aging process, we can delay and potentially prevent these diseases.
Dr. Sarah Espinosa, if you look at frailty, and frailty is a big term, it's an umbrella term, what are you looking at and how does that relate to aging?
Well, frailty is a term that's been used to describe a geriatric syndrome, a syndrome in which people are highly vulnerable to decline and at really high risk for a multitude of adverse outcomes, so falling, disability, hospitalization, and death. And over the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of research has been done to, first of all, define frailty and then understand what sort of the underpinnings of frailty are. But right now, we essentially define frailty as muscle weakness, slowness, unintentional weight loss, sort of sedentary physical activity, and feeling exhausted. And that's the definition that we use to sort of define frailty in our studies.
Now, you are conducting a study here in town, and you're looking for subjects?
Yes.
Human subjects to,
yes.
to participate. Talk about that.
Sure. So the research that I've done over the last 10 years since I joined the Bar Shop in the Health Science Center has really pointed to diabetes as being a major risk factor for becoming frail. So the focus of my current project is to determine whether we can use a medication, metformin, which is commonly used to treat diabetes, but whether we can use that to prevent frailty in older adults who have pre-diabetes. This population of older adults with pre-diabetes, we know they're both at high risk for becoming diabetic or having diabetes, but we also know from my research and as well as many others that they're at high risk for developing frailty. So we are looking for older adults who have pre-diabetes to enter into the study where they would be randomized like the flip of a coin to receive metformin or a dummy pill, placebo, over 2 years. And we will be looking at their frailty status as well as a bunch of other measures that we look at in older persons about every 3 months for 2 years.
And who do they call to if they want to participate in this?
Yes, our phone number is 210-450-0020. And we have a great team of assistants and nurses ready to answer questions that you might have about the study and decide if you might be interested in joining.
The number again?
210-450-0020.
And we'll have that on our website. It's the Metformin Frailty Study. They're seeking 60 with pre-diabetes. Metformin also, taking metformin can cause some sort of like digestive issues as well. There's a lot of things to consider when
yes.
you take metformin. It's not for everyone. We're going to continue our conversation. We're going to take some of these calls. If you've got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The U.S. population is aging rapidly. That's no secret. And it's going to cost the economy more as we take care of our aging population, people with more increased frailty, disease, disabilities, memory loss, and more. What can be done about it? Well, one of the best investments that we can be making to deal with that is to figure out how to fight the conditions that come with old age and whether or not we can help people live with vigor and vitality longer in their lifespan, youth extension. That's what's happening at the Bar Shop Institute. It's a San Antonio facility, research facility, the Bar Shop Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies, part of the UT Health Science Center here in San Antonio. Some of the world's top research in beating aging is happening right here, and we're speaking with three of the experts this afternoon. We welcome your phone calls. If you've got a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. And Ben is on the line. And Ben, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, the lady or the individual that's doing the Alzheimer's study with that project, I'm curious if she's also including other frontotemporal dementias in that.
All right, good question, Ben. I appreciate that. So that would be Dr. Veronica Galvan, and you've been looking at Alzheimer's for quite a while, and you're looking at what, metformin, and how that works with that?
We're now just focused on the target of rapamycin on TOR.
Oh, yeah, rapamycin.
Yeah, yeah. But I have to make this clarification. I am, unlike Dr. Musi and Dr. Espinosa, I am not a clinician. I am a researcher. So basically, I'm a PhD, and what we do is what's called preclinical. So we are basically just only looking at mechanisms, just trying to figure out how things work using models. So we do not have, all our studies are done in experimental models, so in rodents, in. So I am not involved in clinical studies.
Sure, but
study.
You have rodents, rats, lab rats, and you run them through
rats
the...
Rats and mice.
You run them through the maze?
We run them through all sorts of things.
And you're saying then you want to see their mental acuity and then the effects of rapamycin on the rats.
Mm-hmm. And what we do is also, I mean, the powerful part is also there's this very urgent need for identifying interventions. That's very clear. The other side to that is that by identifying, so we, the like Dr. Musi was explaining, the discovery of biology, so regulation, things that we can go and intervene and tweak and modify, like diabetes, you use insulin. That was just because people figured out how the process works. With the drug, in this case, the first one that we started with, which is rapamycin, because we know a lot about what is it precisely that it does, you know, what is the protein that it binds to, what is the way that it works, we can go and investigate that biology. And understanding how that drug works and what it is that it does, it gives us all this knowledge where we can say, oh, wow, look at this. So A binds B and then binds
right.
C. So we can figure out other ways of intervening.
So you look at, so we'll get into rapamycin in just a second, and it's an interesting story in and of itself, but you're looking at that, the fact that it's a TOR inhibitor?
We're looking at the TOR inhibitor, and we're looking at TOR.
And TOR, and so it's sort of like by seeing that rapamycin does something really interesting, let's dig in deeper and deeper into the chemistry here, the biochemistry. What is rapamycin doing? And then how can we duplicate that or even refine it even better?
Exactly.
All right, so to Ben's question, there's all sorts of studies and interventions and approaches being taken to Alzheimer's because this is such a colossal problem that we have facing our medical community, and every possible angle of approach is being taken to figure out how are we going to deal with this. And this is one that's showing a lot of promise.
Yeah, actually, if I may say, so until now, even though we have made important, the field has made important advances in understanding Alzheimer's. 95% of the risk of Alzheimer's disease is just getting old. So the process of aging makes you susceptible to something that was not going to hurt you when you were young. This is very different from other diseases where you have, an infection will make you ill no matter, how old you are. It may be worse when you're old, but it's not dependent on age. Alzheimer's depends. 95% of it depends on age.
And then we have early onset Alzheimer's, and we're finding out that actually Alzheimer's may be there may be different types of Alzheimer's impacting different people in different ways. And so Dr. Musi, you wanted to add to that?
Yes. Just wanted to add that in our clinical research center funded by the National Institute on Aging and the VA, we do have some pilot studies, and we are evaluating novel compounds, including rapamycin and others, for people with mild cognitive impairment, which is considered a pre-dementia stage.
Okay, I'm going to get to another caller, but first I want to mention this before I forget that Texas Public Radio has a Think Science program coming up. Then March 21st, we're going to be talking about the Barshop Institute at that time, and you can make reservations now by going online to tpr.org and getting your free ticket to attend this. It'll be a lecture. It'll be a community conversation live on March 21st with you guys will be there, right? Dr. Musi, I know you'll be there, and all y'all will. So that's something to consider if you're interested in what we're talking about. Patricia has called in. And Patricia, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was just wondering if in any of the studies that you all are doing, if anyone is looking at aging from a sociological factor, because it's my opinion that I think that when we stereotype a number, that it alludes to that aging is a disease, and I don't ascribe to aging as a disease or aging as bad. And I just personally, I think that if we could get more people looking at the sociological factors in the aging process, perhaps stereotyping and dichotomizing it as aging is good, aging is bad, we could get rid of that and just do more of people first kind of idea.
All right, Patricia, thank you for that call. So, Dr. Musi, you're looking just at the science, not looking at, you know, how people categorize others according to their age. I mean, you know, if people are losing life, you know, are dying from old age, you know, that's something that needs to be dealt with at that angle.
Yes. I thank the caller, and I...
She makes an interesting point.
Oh, absolutely, and I agree. Aging is a process, a biologic process that, of course, also involves a number of other factors, including social factors. And I also agree that we should not try to label aging as a disease or necessarily a bad thing. And understanding the social context of aging, it is absolutely critical. And we have some research ongoing related to the effect, for example, of being a caregiver and how that impacts the social context and also how affects the biology of aging. Dr. Espinosa has also conducted research related to social factors and frailty in aging. So that is a key area that we're also trying to advance the science there.
So, Dr. Espinosa.
Sure. So some of the research that I did in conjunction with Dr. Helen Hazuda, who's a professor of medicine at the Health Science Center, in her cohort, we've shown that some social factors are associated with frailty, and many others have shown this as well. But primarily, lower socioeconomic status is associated with frailty. So less access maybe to medical care and general overall health care, perhaps over the lifespan, not just during ages 65 and up. And although in my current research it's not a major focus, I am doing other assessments of health, including depression screen and screening for overall well-being that I monitor over the course of the study to determine if metformin might impact these in a good way.
Okay, another caller with Al. And Al, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Mr. Davies, for taking my call. I'm going to keep this very brief. I am an aging Vietnam veteran, and I happen to be a volunteer participant in Dr. Espinosa's study. So first, I want to thank your guests, Dr. Espinosa, Dr. Galvan, and Dr. Musi, for the privilege of participating in their research on aging. That's number one. And then I want to say that I know that my small part as a research volunteer it'll also benefit my fellow veterans, because eventually I'm sure the results of research translates into practical medical knowledge that the medical profession, doctors, nurses, etc., can use to help patients everywhere, including veterans like me, as we all get older. It gives me a good feeling to know that I'm a small part of the worthy effort. So again, thank you, all three of your guests. It's just wonderful being a small part.
All right, Al, thank you for that great call. I appreciate it. So, Dr. Espinosa, you seem to be beaming about this call. You know, so do you know?
Yes.
You know something we don't know?
Oh well, I'm just very happy to hear a friendly voice, and it's been a pleasure working with Mr. Bouton, and it's people like him that first of all make my job very rewarding, because I just enjoy interacting with people like him. They're so engaged in their community and want to make a difference. And we cannot do the research without our participants. So I'm just very appreciative for all the kind words.
Yeah, but so this is an opportunity for San Antonio and for San Antonians to participate in something that could change the world. You know, if we can push back aging for adults, expanding vitality 10, 15, 20% in a person's lifespan, that's a big difference. You alleviate a lot of suffering. It's a big deal. Dr. Galvan?
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize the uniqueness of the research that we are able to do. Having now an understanding of the mechanisms or a little, window into these mechanisms that make, the way that the clock ticks, and all of a sudden you become vulnerable to certain diseases that are going to, impact on your quality of life. So we have this, the difference, why our research is different, is that instead of not blindly, but essentially trying different avenues and, testing different hypotheses, here we are essentially driven by these cues, these tips that we got from understanding how is it, the biology of aging. So what are the mechanisms that control that? And so that gives us a unique perspective on it. And that's why I think it's very important. It's like having really, really a good hunch. I think that we are following the right leads.
And everyone's got a stake in this, particularly I seem to be getting more and more interested in this topic every passing day for some reason. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Galvan, so what are things that people can do to lessen their chance of actually being diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
At this time, it all comes down to just what your mom used to tell you in terms of eat well, take lots of care of yourself, and stay active. And very, very importantly, it turns out that any amount of exercise, and this goes back to Dr. Moose's focus, any amount of exercise is going to make a difference. And social engagement, having a rich social life and contacts and experience, trying to maintain those two things are critical.
How do you do that with the lab rats? Do you have like little parties for them, or what do you do?
They are living little communities, so they're taken care of.
Yeah. So they engage with each other. Okay, and we're going to get into exercise in just a bit, a lot more in depth to find out how exercise and also rapamycin, where it came from, what it means, how this is being developed. There's a lot of big issues we're going to be tackling in the next half hour. Call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It was once thought that it was unavoidable, that as you got older, you were going to get old. You had all those problems of getting older, loss of tissue, elasticity, inflammation of the joints, loss of bone density, muscle tone, the weakness of the immune system, all these things that happen to you as you get old that you want to avoid. Well, each one of these things doesn't have to happen. We know that people age differently and that some people have great genes. Why does one person able to live long and be vital longer and the other person not so much? What's happening about that? Well, here in San Antonio, a lot of the great research, some of the world's most advanced research is underway, looking to crack that code and hack old age. We're talking about the Barshop Institute, and they're joining us here. We're going to have them with a Think Science event for Texas Public Radio. That's on March 21st. And you can reserve your place online at tpr.org for that event, which will be interesting. Well, exercise. We already hear all the time about how great exercise is for us. Why does it have to be so exercise-y, Dr. Nicholas Moosey? Is there a way you can figure out what it is about exercise and put it in a capsule?
Well, that's certainly a very important question. Exercise has been known for a very long time to be beneficial on many outcomes, reduce disability, prevention and treatment of diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, depression, some cancers are reduced by exercise. So there is no question about that. But
I got a caller who has a question about exercise. Leslie, let's get her question in on here. Leslie, hi, welcome to The Source. You got a question about exercise? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. My question is about the amount of exercise you're talking about, because, like, for instance, my mother-in-law used to get up in the morning and walk a half a block every morning and come back, and she lived into her 80s. Now I have another friend that's also in the 80s and spends quite a bit of time at a gym, does weightlifting a couple hours a week and some, you know, light cardio. So what's the difference of just a little exercise versus a lot?
Right, great call, Leslie. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, that's a very good point. And there is some uncertainty and gaps in the research in terms of the amount that is beneficial. But overall, it is thought that there is a dose response. A little exercise is better than no exercise. And in general, the more exercise, the better. However, we do want to be careful in that excessive exercise can be detrimental, particularly in older adults, can be harmful to the joints, to the muscles. It is not known whether large amounts of exercise are beneficial. So in general, I would say that doing anywhere between 20 to 40 minutes of exercise 3 times per week, moderate intensity exercise, which is essentially enough to break a sweat, is what consistently has been shown to be beneficial in a number of studies and different outcomes. If someone can do a little bit more than that, that is probably going to be further benefit. And if a person is not able to achieve those dose of exercise, that is still going to confer a benefit, because there seems to be a dose response.
Well, we hear about burst exercising, where under a very short period of time, maybe 90 to seconds to 2 minutes, where you want to really get your heart rate up and just really work it, and that you will get more benefit from burst exercising than you will from long endurance training. Do you know about that?
Yes. So there is mode of exercise called HIIT, or high intensity interval training exercise, that it's becoming more popular. And the idea is that short bouts of intensity exercise are maybe better accepted, because it just takes less time, and people often don't have too much time for exercise. There are research data suggesting that it may be as beneficial, if not better, than traditional exercise, and for some outcomes, such as related to effects on glucose metabolism.
Like weight loss.
And weight loss. However, I would say that overall, the science in comparing this approach with a more conventional approach is still early. Data are encouraging, I would say, and hopefully in a few years we'll know more.
All right, so I hear a lot of key words here. So we've been talking about diabetes comes up quite a bit. You talked about glucose metabolism. I'm thinking about the body's ability to process or insulin stress. These things all seem sort of interconnected when we talk about aging. And I'm wondering if you're seeing any of these issues come up with Alzheimer's studies, Dr. Galvan.
The effect of exercise in the field, just looking at risk for Alzheimer's disease in large cohorts. And I can recall two very large studies that showed that just timed exercise and not distance. So in this, this was just walking, and it has been shown very clearly that just walking whatever distance you can walk within 20 minutes, 3 times a week, And this is, a very, very easy task, even for people who are maybe, partially disabled. This is sufficient to significantly decrease the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And this type of large studies just point out to the importance of just moving, essentially just getting out and be able, walk for 20 minutes.
So, Dr. Musi, you're trying to figure out why that is. I mean, what is it about moving your body around for 20 minutes that you're going to see health benefits from? I mean, people don't think about it. They say, well, it makes sense, because we live in the world where, we look at, connectivity, but we're trying to dive deep into the biology of it, right?
Yeah, the reality is that the field, the scientific field has very little knowledge of what exercise does to our cells, to our molecules that control our metabolism and to overall body.
And we don't know what it does to the microbiome that we have with us either.
We don't know what it does to our microbiome. And so the idea is that understanding how exercise works may lead to new ways to mimic the effect of exercise. Of course, first we want to understand how it works and then try to apply that to improve health. So
because there are some people who are bedridden or they suffer from all sorts of problems, they can't benefit from exercise by actually doing it, but maybe we can figure out how can we administer something that would allow them to improve their condition. And so we mentioned rapamycin before, and I really want to get back to you, because I want to get Dr. Galvan about that and Alzheimer's. And so you administer that, you mm-hmm. see benefits with the rats that you work on. But what is this rapamycin stuff?
So rapamycin is a drug that very specifically inhibits a protein. We know a lot about it because it has been around for a long, long time. And so that's very good. What we have found, so we've validated the result, the idea that by using a drug that delays the process of aging, that was the first question. So if you find a drug that delays the process of aging, will it delay the diseases associated with aging? That's why we care. And so what we found, us and other groups, is in four different, completely different, five actually, models of Alzheimer's disease, completely different, it does. So basically you delay the onset or you treat established deficits. And what we do in the lab is trying to figure out what is it that it's doing. So what are the critical effects of the drug that actually, result in this benefit.
And so we know that they've been using rapamycin for many years for organ transplants to get people to not reject organs, but also in that it kind of knocks down the immune system. And so you are susceptible to, disease. Also, it increases your chances of diabetes.
So the interesting thing is that for all this, rapamycin has been used for the most part in combination with other drugs. So it's a cocktail of immunosuppressants. It's really, really, really hard to tease out who is doing what. So that's one big issue. The other one, and this goes back to what Dr. Musi was explaining earlier about the clinical trials that are going on at the Pepper Center and the VA and the Bishop Institute, is that we are now beginning to understand that the older group, so the way that older people react to the drug is very, very different from the way that young people.
Older people can get benefits from
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So as far as we know, and from these small studies that are very, very encouraging, there don't seem to be very, pronounced effects on glucose metabolism or with immune system.
All right, one quick break, 1 minute break. We'll be right back. The phone number to call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980. We're talking with the Bishop Institute, their studies of aging and the promotion of healthy life, living longer with more vitality. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How would you like to live longer and healthier along the way, another maybe 20% added on to your lifespan or your youth span, where when you're 80 years old and you feel like you're 50, or maybe you're 30 or something like that, you know, not have to deal with all of the problems with aging. It would be a kick, wouldn't it? Well, they're working on that over at the Barshop Institute, and we're talking about this afternoon. If you've got a question or a call, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And Craig is on the line. And Craig, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I have two questions. The first question is the study still open for volunteers?
Which study is that? The one about the metformin is.
Yeah, the metformin study is still open?
Yes, it is.
If I'm not taking it now and I'm 78 years old?
Yes.
That's not an automatic qualifier.
Right. We if you call our number, we will ask you some questions over the phone. But everybody comes into our clinic and has an assessment with me and the other study staff, and we will determine whether you're eligible or not. And the benefit actually from that screening process is that everybody at the end of that screening visit, whether you meet the criteria or not, you will know whether you have prediabetes or you're normal, and then very few people.
My PCP has already threatened me with metformin. But anyway,
okay. Well, you are free to call.
And what's the number?
The number is 210-450-0020.
All right, Craig. Thank you for the call, and good luck to you, sir.
Go ahead. Tell me about the value of swimming versus other types of exercise. Do you recognize that as more beneficial to a senior citizen or not?
Exercise it's very beneficial.
But swimming, I mean, it's easier on the joints.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes. Certainly. I meant swimming is very beneficial. It provides many of the effects of what we call aerobic exercise, which is effects on the cardiovascular system, in our lungs, and in our metabolism. And it also provides some resistance to the muscle, which increases muscle strength. So certainly it's very beneficial. Also, for people that have joint problems, it decreases the pressure on the joints. So it's definitely very beneficial. Potential weaknesses compared to other types of exercise, such as running, is that the factor of putting pressure on the bones seems to be important for the beneficial effects of exercise on osteoporosis. So there may be losing some of that, but on the other hand, it does provide many other benefits.
So ideally, someone should be doing a little bit of treadmill work, swimming, and doing a little weightlifting.
Exactly. There is more and more data indicating that combining exercises and modes of exercise, again, what I mentioned as aerobic exercise, which is typically what we think of with a bicycle or jogging or walking at a fast pace, or even swimming, combining that with resistance exercise, which is more on weightlifting, has synergistic or additive effects on many outcomes, including cardiovascular outcomes and metabolic outcomes.
All right. Xavier, welcome to The Source. Thanks for calling in. And Xavier, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, David. Great show. And I never miss your show. I guess you've noticed.
Thanks.
So my question to your guest is, what is the status of research on mole rats and also with shortening of the telomeres and also with starvation? And what are the most promising breakthrough studies that we should be looking forward to? Thank you.
All right, so three big topics right there. So over at the Bar Shop, you have the world's largest colony of naked mole rats there. You're looking at them for comparative biology reason, seeing why these little critters live so long, never get cancer, able to fight off disease and poison and all sorts of things. They're amazing little smelly, ugly creatures. So what are you getting out of that? I mean, have you found out anything?
Knowledge on the biology of the naked mole rat is increasing at a fast pace. Certainly, they seem to be very resistant to stress. And by stress, I mean primarily chemical stress on cells. So we can isolate cells from a naked mole rat versus another type of rodent and treat these cells with different chemicals to see how resistant they are. And clearly, they're very resistant. They also have lower rates of cancer, which is one of the main reasons by which typical lab rodents die.
And it's a leading cause for people. It's a big problem with
exactly,
people.
Exactly, right. So currently the goal is to identify the genes that are expressed in these animals that are conferring them protection. Hopefully in the next few years we'll know more about that. In terms of the nutrition,
The fasting,
yeah. So calorie restriction or reducing the amount of calories has been known for a long time that it slows down aging. And that and by that not only prolongs longevity, but also decreases a number of diseases of aging in rodents. Data on other species is scarce. There are data on non-human primates suggesting that it may also be beneficial, although the effects don't seem to be as striking as findings in rodents. And studies in humans are beginning, and there's obviously very difficult research in humans because reducing the amount of calories for a prolonged period of time is very unpractical. But hopefully in a few years we will
know more. Well, there are people who are doing it. They're self-experimenting, you know, on themselves, and they're doing long-time fasting. You know, you go to these fasting banquets, they're not a whole lot going on there. And but there's people doing periodic fasting, and they're looking at if I go a day or two without eating, and they are seeing that they are benefiting from their insulin resistance, their ability to process sugar. There are also all sorts of good things coming, apparently. I don't know. That's what I'm reading, but I haven't seen the scientific literature.
No, these are fascinating questions. Research in rodents about intermittent fasting, it is intriguing. Does seem to have an important effect on aging and some cancers, on recovering from chemotherapy, things of that nature, in improving the function of stem cells. And again, this is all in rodents. There are some early trials that are being conducted in human subjects, for example, evaluating the effect of intermittent fasting on recovery after chemotherapy, for example. And I think in the near future, we'll know more about this.
And Dr. Sara Espinosa, I got an email question from Kathy. How does inflammation factor into aging and anti-inflammatory diet and help regarding aging? So anti-inflammatory diet, I think that's kind of code for gluten. You know, people are trying to stay away from wheat and gluten and things. But also the most common anti-inflammatory product out there is aspirin. And I know you've done work in aspirin.
Right. Yes. So first I'll say that we do know that frailty is associated with increased inflammation. But why that is not really known. So there's research going on in that particular area, including my study, which will look at whether metformin reduces inflammation and if that is the mechanism by which we might be able to prevent frailty. With regard to anti-inflammatory diet, we do know that, you know, a diet rich in fruits and vegetables can help prevent cancer. But as far as how gluten-free diet affects aging. I'm not aware of any research in that area. I don't know if Dr. Musi is aware, but I don't believe there's anything out there yet on that.
I know science takes a dim view of what's going on with the gluten craze here. But, you know, people are thinking about, you know, you eat a lot of processed food. It does seem to be an inflammatory, you know, what's in there. And so anything, if you say it's gluten, not gluten, but you steer towards more natural, more clean eating, you're going to benefit from that, I imagine.
Yes. I mean, there's a multitude of studies that show that diet rich in fruit and vegetables and lean meat are better for prevention of particularly cancer. But with regard to aspirin, we are doing a trial now, which is not open for recruitment, but we're ongoing following subjects who are healthy older patients who don't have dementia or disability. And the goal of the study is to see whether low dose, like baby aspirin, can prevent dementia and disability over a 5-year period. And we are just one of several sites in the United States and Australia. It's studied, is funded by the NIA. And we should know, I think, in the next year or so if aspirin prevents dementia. And the primary mechanism by which they think that it might is the anti-inflammatory properties.
So it would probably be a low dosage of aspirin a day?
Yes, like a baby aspirin a day, yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all very much. The Barshop Institute and Texas Public Radio will have a Think Science presentation on March 21st. And this is a topic that you can go enjoy. You can register online at tpr.org. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.